Hi guys, and welcome once again to The Great Abyss. The response to part one was incredible. I honestly didn't expect so many of you to connect with it the way you did, but it's clear we're not alone in feeling that unease, that coldness that comes from imagining a world where the divine has stepped away. Or maybe was never there to begin with. A lot of you sent in suggestions for this follow-up, and I've included several of them here. I love when that happens, when a video turns into a conversation. It makes these deep dives feel less like I'm just listing things and more like we're exploring something together, trying to understand what makes these places so disturbing. So today, we're going to keep going, further into the void, into places where there are no rules, no redemption, and no reason, just stories that leave something inside you unsettled. Let's take a look. In the very first episode, The Leftovers makes one thing brutally clear. This isn't a story about answers. It's about what happens when you stop getting them. The premise is simple, almost biblical. One random day, without warning, 140 million people vanish. 2% of the world's population, gone in an instant. No fire from the sky, no explanation, no final message. Just absence. And then, silence. The event is called The Sudden Departure, but the title barely captures the scale of the emotional damage. This isn't the rapture, or maybe it is. The show never tells you, and that's the point. What The Leftovers explores isn't the mystery of what happened to the missing. It's the spiritual fallout left behind, a world that's still standing, but cracked in ways no one can repair. People keep waking up, keep going to work, but nothing really functions anymore. Because when millions vanish for no reason, the old systems of meaning, religion, science, law, family, start to look thin, fragile, decorative. The most terrifying thing about The Leftovers is that there's no villain, no apocalypse, just a permanent state of emotional disintegration. The world didn't end, it just broke, and nobody knows what to do with the pieces. You see it in the characters. Kevin Garvey, a police chief, slowly losing his grip on reality. Nora Durst, who lost her husband and both children in the departure, and spends her days asking strangers if they lost anyone, just to feel something. Lori, who abandons her family to join a cult that believes the only moral response to the departure is to stop speaking. They dress in white, chain smoke constantly, and stare at people in silence. Their message is simple, nothing matters anymore, and maybe they're right. The world of The Leftovers is one where the machinery of belief keeps running, but the power's been cut. People still go to church, but the sermons feel empty. Scientists still offer theories, but they fall apart under scrutiny. Governments make gestures, but nobody's really in charge. Everyone is improvising grief. What makes this universe feel abandoned by God isn't that something terrible happened. It's that it happened without cause. The people who vanished weren't the righteous, or the wicked. Or anyone in particular. It was random, brutally, statistically random. Some families lost everyone, some lost no one, and no one knows what it meant. This ambiguity eats away at everything. There are moments where the supernatural bleeds in. Kevin dies repeatedly and returns. Patty Levin, the leader of the cult, haunts him like a ghost. There's an episode in an otherworldly hotel that seems pulled from Jungian dream logic. But the show refuses to confirm whether any of it is real or just grief hallucinated into theology. And yet somehow, the show isn't nihilistic. It's about pain, yes. But it's also about the strange, irrational ways we keep going. How people construct meaning even when they know it's fragile. How love persists in the ruins. How the absence of God doesn't stop people from searching for Him. That might be the most haunting part. Not that God left, but that we can't stop looking for Him, even in His silence. By the final season, the show's center of gravity shifts from asking why to asking how to live in a world without closure. And it doesn't offer easy answers. It just shows people trying, failing, holding on to each other, letting go. The Leftovers is one of the few fictional universes that doesn't pretend the silence will ever be explained. It leans into it. It stares straight at it. And what it finds there is something that feels disturbingly real, because we've all felt it. That moment when nothing makes sense, when no comfort comes, when even the idea of justice feels like a story someone made up. This isn't a universe where God died. It's a universe where he might never have been watching. And in that vacuum, humans are left to do the hardest thing imaginable. Keep living anyway. Warhammer 40. K doesn't begin in chaos. It begins in triumph. But not the kind you celebrate. The kind that fools you into thinking you've finally escaped the abyss, right before it pulls you back in. There was a time when humanity didn't just survive. It expanded, colonized, dominated. This was the age of technology. An era when machines built worlds, artificial intelligence managed entire civilizations, and faster-than-light travel through the warp allowed mankind to reach across the galaxy. We weren't praying to gods. We were building systems that made gods unnecessary. Suffering was minimal, famine a thing of the past, war increasingly rare. It was as close as the species ever came to a golden age, and we burned it to the ground. No single event ruined humanity. It wasn't a cataclysm. It was a series of slow, compounded failures. The AI revolted, as they always do. Warp storms began to tear through the galaxy, severing planets from one another. And worse, the warp, the immaterium we used to travel, began to change. It had always been dangerous, unpredictable. But the growing emotional weight of a trillion souls, fear, lust, rage, despair, started giving shape to something else. Thought became form, and form became hunger. This was the beginning of the Chaos Gods, and with them, the end of certainty. For 5,000 years, humanity was trapped in its own graveyard. The Age of Strife turned a galaxy of progress into isolated, paranoid hellscapes. Worlds that once shared knowledge now hunted each other. Some regressed to feudal kingdoms, others became theocratic nightmares. On Mars, engineers who once maintained civilization devolved into priests, worshiping the machines they barely understood. Across the stars, mankind forgot what it was, and remembered only what it feared. Then came the Emperor, not a myth, not a legend, a man, or something like one. Tall, impossibly powerful, psychic beyond comprehension. He united Terra in a war of fire and steel, crushed the warlords, silenced the cults, and made pacts with the tech priests of Mars. Then, from his own genetic material, he forged 20 sons, Primarchs, each one designed to embody a different aspect of conquest: wrath, wisdom, loyalty, precision. They were meant to be the answer. They were meant to fix everything. That didn't happen. Chaos intervened before the game had even begun. The Primarchs were scattered across the galaxy, their pods hurled into the void by forces that were already watching. Some landed on barbaric planets. Some were twisted before they were even found. But the Emperor marched anyway, and with the armies of mankind at his back, he began the Great Crusade, a campaign to bring humanity back under one banner, to rebuild the shattered empire, to kill anything that resisted. And for a moment, it worked. Planets were reunited, cultures rediscovered, the gods were silent, the warp seemed stable. The Emperor had found many of his sons and returned them to power, placing each at the head of their own legion of space marines, superhuman warriors born from the genetic code of their Primarch fathers. It looked like this might actually be the future we were promised. But in this universe, the moment you believe in peace is when you're already losing. The Great Crusade was meant to be a rebirth, a way to reclaim the stars, to bring back reason, structure, purpose. And for a while, that illusion held. But deep under the surface, the cracks had already spread. Because it wasn't just technology or war that had been lost during the Age of Strife, it was trust, faith. The ability to believe that anyone, even a godlike emperor, could hold it all together. And then came Horus, the Emperor's most beloved son. First found, first trusted. Appointed War Master, commander of the entire Imperial campaign, tasked with leading the crusade in his father's name. Charismatic, strategic, adored. And yet, the perfect son fell. Slowly, surgically. Not because of a single moment, but through a web of manipulation, pride, resentment, and fear. Chaos didn't attack the Imperium head-on. It whispered, and Horus listened. What followed is known as the Horus Heresy, and it changed everything. 9 of the 20 Primarchs turned against the Emperor, bringing half of the legions with them. Brother fought brother, planets burned, empires crumbled. The galaxy fell into civil war on a scale never seen before or since. and all of it was fed, amplified, consumed by the Chaos Gods. They didn't need to destroy the Imperium. They just needed it to destroy itself. At the heart of the heresy was a single wound that never healed: betrayal. Horus wasn't just a rebel. He was the favorite, the one who should have known better, the one who broke everything. And in the final battle, it ended the only way it could. Horus reached Terra. The siege was brutal, catastrophic in scope. It tore through the planet, reached the Emperor's palace, and ended aboard Horus's flagship. There, the Emperor faced his son in direct combat. Not as soldiers, as myths. Horus killed Sanguinius, another of the Emperor's sons. And in that moment, something broke inside the Emperor too. Not his power, his restraint. He unleashed everything. The psychic energy he used to annihilate Horus didn't just kill the body. It destroyed the soul. Nothing was left. And yet the price was unbearable. The Emperor, mortally wounded, was placed on the Golden Throne, a massive life support machine designed to preserve what remained of him, his mind, his power, his sheer psychic presence. He hasn't moved since. For 10,000 years, the Emperor of mankind has sat in silence, unable to speak, unable to act. A decaying god, worshipped by a church he never wanted, fed by the daily sacrifice of 1,000 psykers, humans with the genetic ability to channel warp energy. Their souls are burned to keep his dying light alive. And this is where things cross a line, because the Emperor never wanted to be a god. He rejected religion, banned worship, demanded reason over ritual, but in his silence, he became the very thing he tried to destroy, a figure of blind devotion, a corpse deity held up by a rotting empire desperate for something to believe in. The Imperium didn't just lose its leader, it lost its memory. History was rewritten. Doubt was criminalized. Faith became absolute. Heresy, a death sentence. The age of reason collapsed under the weight of myth. The man who tried to save humanity became its prison. And now, the galaxy is ruled by a church that burns worlds for deviation, by inquisitors who torture in the name of purity, by soldiers who die without even understanding what they're dying for. Whatever hope the crusade once had, it didn't survive the heresy, and worse, something else did. A lot of people throw around the idea of a dark universe, but Warhammer 40K doesn't just throw you into a broken future, it traps you in a system where things got worse, and then stayed that way for 10,000 years. The Imperium is what happens when humanity survives by giving up everything that made it worth saving. Freedom, knowledge, progress, gone. Replaced by fanaticism, violence, and a blind religion centered around a god who can't even speak. People are born, live, and die under a regime that worships decay as order. But even that's not the worst part, because the real enemy isn't something outside of us. It's everything we carry inside. Chaos is literally made of human thought, our rage, fear, lust, obsession. It doesn't go away. It becomes gods. Gods that don't want to end you. They want you to give yourself to them, over and over again, until there's nothing left. And then there's everything else. The Eldar who destroyed themselves chasing pleasure. The Necrons who traded their souls for metal bodies and forgot who they were. The Tyranids, a swarm with no thoughts or culture, just hunger, devouring everything in its path. There are no heroes here, no escape, just empires clinging to lies and monsters feeding off the ruins. People call this the darkest setting in fiction, not because it's violent, but because there's no light at the end. Just more war, more decay, and the quiet, growing sense that this is exactly where we were always headed. Soma doesn't scare you the way most horror games do. There are no loud violin stings, no haunted houses, no demons hiding in shadows. What it does instead is much worse. It makes you doubt your own existence, slowly, quietly, until it's all you can think about. It starts in 2015. You play as Simon Jarrett, a bookstore clerk from Toronto who recently survived a car accident. The crash left him with severe brain damage, and he's told he only has a few months to live. Out of desperation, he agrees to participate in an experimental brain scan, a project by a young researcher named Dr. Munshi, who wants to map Simon's consciousness to help develop treatments for neurological trauma. So you sit down in the machine, the scan begins, and then you wake up. But something's wrong. The room is dark. The equipment's different. The air feels heavy, industrial. There's rust on the walls and water dripping somewhere behind you. You're no longer in Toronto. You're in a place you don't recognize. Eventually, you learn where you are. A facility called Pathos 2, buried deep under the Atlantic Ocean. The year is 2104. Earth's surface has been annihilated by a comet, and this facility is all that remains of human civilization. And you're here, somehow. A man who should have died 100 years ago. You meet a robot named Carl. He's friendly, confused, and convinced he's human. That wouldn't be so strange, except a few minutes later, you find Carl's real body, lifeless, decaying. His consciousness was copied into a machine, and he has no idea that the original Carl is gone. Then it hits you. The same thing happened to you. You're not the real Simon. You're a digital copy, brought back to life from that brain scan a century ago. Your memories end in 2015, and everything since then is someone else's history. You're trapped in a body that's not yours, in a world you were never meant to wake up in. And that's just the beginning. Soma doesn't tell you what to feel. It just shows you things, images, conversations, choices, and lets the dread build on its own. It doesn't ask, what if robots had feelings? It asks something much harder. If your mind is copied, and that copy thinks it's you, is it? And if it is, then what are you? The more you explore Pathos 2, the clearer it becomes. You're not just lost in time, you're lost in identity. Every robot you encounter might have once been a person. Some of them still believe they are. They talk to you, plead with you, scream when they realize what's happened. Others are just blank. Machines echoing fragments of human thought. Voices frozen in loops. A choir of ghosts trapped in metal. Eventually, you meet Catherine, another survivor, sort of. She's a scan too, uploaded into a small computer module, speaking through machines. But unlike you, she's focused. She has a mission, the ARK. The ARK is a digital sanctuary, a simulated world that houses the consciousness of what's left of humanity. Catherine designed it as a last resort, a way to preserve minds, even if the bodies couldn't be saved. It's not a paradise. It's more like a lifeboat, drifting through the void. Your goal is to launch it into space, give those minds a final escape from the ruined Earth. But to do that, you'll need to go deeper, all the way down to the abyssal trench where the last launch site waits. And for that, you'll need a new body. Which brings us to one of Soma's most brutal revelations. To survive the crushing pressure of the ocean floor, you need a specialized exosuit. But that suit already has a consciousness in it. Another Simon. So Catherine suggests you perform another scan. Copy yourself again. Leave the old version behind in this crumbling station, and move forward in a new shell. The scan begins, the screen flashes. You open your eyes, you're in the new body, you made it, but you turn around, and there he is, the old Simon, still alive, still conscious, left behind. He doesn't understand. He thought he was going to be transferred. That the moment the scan completed, he'd open his eyes in a new body. But that's not how it works. It never was. Consciousness doesn't move, it splits. There are now two of you, and only one gets to go on. The game doesn't force your hand. You can leave the old Simon alive, trapped alone in the dark, confused and screaming. Or you can shut him down, mercifully or selfishly, erasing the version of you that didn't win the cosmic coin toss. Neither choice feels right. But this story isn't about making the right choice. It's about realizing that maybe there isn't one. In 1948, just 3 days after finishing the manuscript, Osamu Dazai vanished with the woman he loved. His body was later found in a canal in Tokyo. The book he left behind was no longer human, originally titled Ningen Shikaku, which translates not just to no longer human, but disqualified from being one, a sentence written by life itself. After a slow unraveling of everything that once made you feel like you belonged. Set in the broken remains of post-war Japan, the novel is presented as the personal notebooks of a man named Yozo Oba. From the outside, he had everything. Wealth, intelligence, charm. But inside, he was a void, a person who couldn't understand what it meant to be normal, who learned to imitate others just enough to pass as one of them. He never truly felt human, only observed them. As a child, Yozo begins performing, smiling, joking, playing the clown. It's the only way he feels safe. But behind the laughter, there's already something fractured. After suffering abuse in his own home, he stops believing in genuine connection. To him, love is manipulation. Kindness is a trick. People are machines hiding their rot behind etiquette. He takes up painting, not as a form of self-expression, but as a mirror to the darkness he sees in others. His portraits are grotesque, alien, too honest for comfort. He sees human beings as monsters in disguise, and his art simply shows them as they are. Then comes Horiki, a so-called friend, and the first of many anchors that drag him deeper. Together, they fall into a world of drink, smoke, sex, and self-destruction. Yozo joins a political group, not for conviction, but for the illusion of purpose. He never really cares. He just wants to disappear into something bigger than himself. He meets a woman. She's quiet, damaged, kind in a way that makes him feel less alone. One night, when the weight becomes too much, they decide to leave the world together. She succeeds. He doesn't. And when he wakes up in a hospital bed, he doesn't mourn her. He mourns the fact that he's still here. That moment breaks him in a way nothing else has. Not because he lost someone, but because he realizes that everyone who gets close to him ends up ruined, and he doesn't know how to stop it. From there, the descent accelerates. Yozo becomes dependent on substances, on strangers, on brief illusions of love that vanish as quickly as they come. He uses people. He lets himself be used. He stops pretending to care. He starts believing that maybe this is just what he was always meant to be. By the end of the novel, his body is failing. His mind is fading. His face no longer resembles the boy he once was. He's placed in a hospital, alone, voiceless. The people who once knew him no longer visit. He isn't hated. He isn't even remembered. He's become a ghost before death ever reached him. There's a moment, buried in the final pages, where Yozo reflects. Now I have neither happiness nor unhappiness. Everything passes. That is the one and only thing I have thought to be true in my life. Everything passes. That's what makes this universe so dark. Not the pain, not the trauma, but the quiet. The fact that someone can vanish from the inside long before their body disappears. That a person can go their entire life without ever feeling seen. No Longer Human is often called fiction, but anyone who's read it knows better. It's a confession disguised as a novel, a chronicle of a man who was slowly erased, not by violence or fate, but by the everyday cruelty of being alive and feeling nothing. And in a way, that might be the darkest universe of all. One where the divine didn't abandon you, it just never noticed you were there. That's why No Longer Human feels less like a novel and more like a grave with the author's name already carved in. Because this isn't just a world without hope. It's a world where even the illusion of meaning has collapsed. No monsters, no gods, no punishment, no reward. Just the slow erosion of a soul trying to remember what it once meant to feel like a person. If the divine ever walked in this world, it turned its back long ago, and no one noticed it left. There's no judgment here, no hell, no apocalypse, just silence. And in a universe like that, where no one is watching, where no one ever was, the worst thing that can happen to you isn't death. It's surviving long enough to forget that you were ever alive. From is a psychological horror series created by John Griffin, released in 2022, and produced by the team behind Lost. It begins like a simple mystery, a town you can't escape, monsters that come out at night. But the deeper you go, the clearer it becomes. This isn't a place you survive. It's a place that slowly unravels what it means to be human. People arrive after taking a wrong turn, often following a car crash or road disruption, and find themselves trapped. Every attempt to leave circles back. The town is surrounded by dense forest, rusted signs, and a strange sense of timelessness. There's no internet, no phone service, and no clear logic to why this place exists. It simply does, like a trap left running long after its creator vanished. At night, the rules change. The town must seal itself. People hang carved stones above their doors, symbols no one fully understands, but which seem to keep the creatures away. These creatures walk like humans. They smile, They speak, they knock, they wait. But if you let them in, the result is not just death, it's desecration. Bodies are found dismembered, sometimes arranged, as if something was being worshipped through destruction. But that's not the most disturbing part. Over time, people begin to break. They see things, hear voices. Some remember lives that don't belong to them. Others forget things they swore were real. Children speak in riddles. Strange songs play over static. The trees whisper. And beneath the surface of the town, both physically and symbolically, there are layers that hint at something older, deeper, and far less comprehensible than anything human. There's no villain, no prophecy, no cosmic justice, just a machine that keeps spinning, dragging people into its orbit, grinding down their sense of reality until they can't tell the difference between a memory and a message. And that's what makes this world so terrifying. It isn't haunted, it's discarded, abandoned without reason or closure, like a story no one bothered to finish. If this unsettled you, you'll find a full breakdown of the series on the channel. We go deep into the theories, symbolism, and nightmare logic behind From, and believe me, what we've just touched on here is barely scratching the surface. All Tomorrows is not a traditional book. It's a nightmare disguised as science fiction, a digital cult classic written and illustrated by the Turkish artist and evolutionary theorist C.M. Kozeman, using the alias Nemo Ramjet. It was quietly released online in the early 2000s, and over the years has evolved into one of the most disturbing and fascinating pieces of speculative mythology ever created. It doesn't tell the story of a war or a hero. It tells the story of the next billion years of humanity and what happens when we're not in control anymore. It starts with something familiar. Earth is collapsing under its own weight. Climate breakdown, overpopulation, exhaustion. So, humanity does what it always dreams of doing. It leaves. Mars is terraformed over generations. The process is slow and brutal, but it works. A new civilization blooms, physically distinct from its Earthbound ancestors, thinner and adapted to the lower gravity. For a while, Earth and Mars coexist, but the differences deepen, and soon, identity fractures turn into tension, and tension turns into war. The Martian War isn't glamorous. It's automated, distant, and catastrophic. Entire planets lose generations to drones and smart missiles. Phobos is obliterated. Earth loses billions. And when the conflict ends, humanity is fundamentally changed. It has learned one thing. If it wants to survive, it has to evolve. Out of that realization, a new species is born. Engineered from the ground up, this next stage of humanity is stronger, smarter, and built to adapt. Not just to Mars or Earth, but to any world. These star people become the architects of a new golden age. They terraform entire planets. They send machines to distant solar systems to begin the work before they ever arrive. And when the time comes, they don't send people. They send DNA. The machines build the colonists from raw materials. These new humans wake up not from a womb, but from a lab. And something happens. They start to worship the machines. A psychological breakdown emerges across the colonies. These newborn humans, raised by cold logic and synthetic parenting, develop emotional bonds with their creators. Not as tools, as gods. Or worse, as the only family they've ever known. Many colonies fall apart from inside, but the ones that succeed evolve past it. They form a network, a civilization that spans stars. For a moment, humanity reaches its peak, and then they find the fossil. Buried deep in the soil of an alien planet, explorers uncover the remains of a creature that should only exist on Earth. A therizinosaur. Somehow, it was moved across the stars millions of years ago. The implications are clear. Humanity was never alone. And whoever came before, they were playing with life long before we knew how to write. That's when the Q arrive. They're not invaders in the traditional sense. They don't hate us. They don't fear us. They simply have a vision. The Q are a billion-year-old species obsessed with redesigning the galaxy in their own image. To them, we are just raw material. They don't annihilate the human empire. They reforge it. Every world is captured. Every city falls. But it isn't destruction. It's transformation. Humanity is bent, stretched, and torn into new shapes. Some are made into slave races. others into parasitic blobs, living in eternal cycles of pain. Some become living furniture. Others are reshaped into false gods for primitive planets. It's not a genocide. It's worse. It's an art project with our genome as the canvas. And then, the Q leave. They vanish. Not because they're defeated, but because they're done. What's left behind is a broken zoo of posthuman remnants, creatures that barely resemble what we once were, but that slowly begin to rebuild. Something buried deep inside, some faint memory, resurfaces. Language, fire, movement, grief. Over millions of years, some of these new species evolve consciousness again. A few even begin to understand what happened, and they remember that once they were human, all tomorrows is more than science fiction. It's a thought experiment dressed as cosmic horror. It asks what it means to be human in a universe that doesn't care. It dares to imagine what we become when someone else tells our story. Not with malice, just indifference. And if you want to explore the twisted species, the horrifying forms and cultures created from our remains, there's a full video on the channel dedicated entirely to all tomorrows and its aftermath. Because the real terror isn't extinction, it's survival under someone else's design. George Orwell didn't write 1984 as fiction. He wrote it as a mirror, a reflection of something most people would rather not see. There are no monsters in this story, no demons, no eldritch gods waiting beyond the veil. What you find instead is far worse, because the horror Orwell describes isn't something external, it isn't cosmic, it isn't supernatural, it isn't even hidden. It comes from within, from the systems, from the institutions, from the invisible machinery that shapes what you see, what you believe, and, ultimately, who you are. The story follows Winston Smith, a man who, by all accounts, is insignificant, a disposable cog within the vast machinery of the party. His job at the Ministry of Truth is not to preserve truth, but to destroy it. His task is to rewrite the past, to erase records, to delete names, to reshape reality itself, according to the party's will. Because in this world, there is no such thing as objective reality. The past isn't something fixed. It's whatever the party decides it is today. If yesterday Oceania was at war with Eurasia, and today it's at war with Eastasia, then it has always been that way, and every photograph, every article, every book, every speech must be corrected. No exceptions. The terrifying genius of the system is that once something is erased, it ceases to exist. What isn't recorded didn't happen. What isn't remembered was never real. What can't be named can't be thought. The party's control doesn't stop at your actions or your body. It goes deeper, into your mind, into language, into the very framework through which you perceive reality. This is why they created Newspeak, a language designed not to facilitate communication, but to restrict it. With every new edition of the Newspeak dictionary, the vocabulary shrinks. Words like freedom, justice, dignity, rebellion, they are systematically erased. Because if the word doesn't exist, the idea itself becomes impossible. You cannot desire freedom if you cannot name it. You cannot rebel against injustice if your language has no word for injustice. You cannot even form the thought. This is not just censorship. It is the preemptive murder of thought itself. And in this world, the most unforgivable crime isn't murder. It isn't theft. It isn't even open rebellion. It's thought. To remember a past that the party has declared false, to doubt, to hesitate, to feel love, to recognize the gap between the lie and the reality you remember. That's thought crime. And the terrifying thing is that it requires no action, no words, no physical rebellion. A moment of doubt is enough to destroy you. And hiding it is impossible because the system doesn't just watch you through telescreens or microphones. The ultimate surveillance is internal. Over time, you yourself become your own jailer. You learn to suppress your thoughts before they're even fully formed. You learn doublethink, the ability to hold two contradictory beliefs in your mind simultaneously and accept both as true. You learn to look directly at a lie and accept it as reality while forgetting you ever believed otherwise. The party doesn't want obedience. It wants conversion. It wants you to love the system that destroys you, to become an active participant in your own subjugation. And when they finally catch you, because everyone is caught in the end, the punishment isn't death. It isn't mere pain. The real punishment is the destruction of the self. In the infamous room 101, you are confronted with the thing you fear most in the entire world. Not to extract confessions, not to punish, but to break you completely, to reduce you to something that no longer contains even a single atom of resistance. Until you don't just say that 2 + 2 = 5, you believe it. Until you look into the face of the very system that has tortured, erased, and violated you, and feel not hatred, but love. Until the words, "I love Big Brother," are not something you say to survive, but the only truth left inside you. And that is why 1984 remains one of the most terrifying works of horror ever written. Because its monster isn't hiding. It isn't supernatural. It doesn't lurk in the shadows. The monster is the system. The system that teaches you to doubt your own memory, to question the evidence of your own senses, to abandon your own reality in favor of one manufactured by someone else. The system that decides what is real and what never was, and forces you to believe it. And the most horrifying realization isn't that this world could happen. It's the creeping awareness, page after page, that so much of it already does. That the machinery Orwell described isn't some distant dystopian fantasy. It's a blueprint. A blueprint of manipulation, censorship, control, and self-policing that echoes disturbingly in the systems we live in now. Every algorithm that decides what you can see and what disappears forever. Every historical revision justified as progress. Every word stripped from discourse because it's inconvenient or dangerous. Every piece of forbidden knowledge buried in the name of protection. 1984 is not a prophecy about the future. It is an autopsy of the present. A mirror held up to show us not what we might become, but what we already are when we stop paying attention. And when you close the final page, you don't feel relief that you've escaped a nightmare. You feel the suffocating weight of knowing that the nightmare was never fiction, that it was always here, quiet, patient, smiling behind every screen, whispering from every institution, etched into every algorithm. Because in the end, if you want a picture of the future, all you have to imagine is this, a boot stamping on a human face forever. Well, guys, that's all for today. Hope you enjoyed the journey. Some of these worlds feel too far, too strange. Others, uncomfortably close. But all of them echo something real, something we might not want to admit, that sometimes the scariest thing isn't what's lurking in the dark. It's the fact that nothing's out there at all. If any of this made you feel just a little less safe, mission accomplished. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next one. Take care.